So, welcome everybody. This is the seventh lecture in my course on Tranquility and Insight in Early Buddhist Discourse. There has been a short interruption in the OLAT system, I think, and so I apologize if this has prevented anybody from posting on the forum, but still there are a few who have posted. So I will first turn to these and then look at the next discourses in our series. The first is again Justin Williams. You might remember that last time in reply to another question posed by him, I discussed the fact that in the Brahmajala Sutta, it seems very clear that jhana was practiced by contemporaries of the Buddha. So he puts this question regarding the Brahmajala Sutta. Do we have an idea of how early the sutta is? Is this the only reference for proposing the view that others, non-Buddhists, were practicing jhana? If so, is this not as shaky an idea as the idea of the Brahmaviharas as a complete path, which is based also on only one sutta? I do not mean to be abrasive. Yeah, the Brahmajala Sutta we have in a number of different versions. I have done a comparative study of the second part on the views based on a translation of the Chinese version. We have two Tibetan versions. We have a version quoted in the Shariputta Abhidharma Shastra. And the Brahmajala Sutta is also mentioned in several Vinayas in the story of the First Sangiti, the collection of Buddhist discourses. So in as far as earliness is concerned, the Brahmajala Sutta clearly stands within the layer of early Buddhist discourses. And the exposition of views that we have in this discourse is very closely similar. We do see some development in the first section of the discourse, which treats the moralities. And there, the Tibetan version, the Mula Savastivada version, seems to have a shorter description of the moralities, and the others seem to have further developed. But as far as the exposition of views are concerned, I think it is very clear that this is early material. Then is this the only reference for proposing the view? Well, as I think I may have mentioned already, the other reference is the account of the in the Aryaparyesana Sutta of the Bodhisattva's training under Alara Kalama and Udakarama Putta. And I just pick up here the Pali again. So according to the Aryaparyesana Sutta, I am page 165 of the PTS edition. After training under Alara Kalama and reaching the same degree of attainment and being invited to be a co-teacher, the discourse describes the Bodhisattva Gotama's reflection as Nayang dhammo nibidayana viragayana niruddhayana upasamayana abhinyayana sampodayana nibbanaya sangvatantati. So this teaching does not lead to dispassion, etc., nirvana. Yavad eva akinchanya yatan upapatantiya, but only to the arising in the sphere of nothingness. So it is indubitably clear from this discourse that the attainment they are talking about is the full attainment of akinchanya yatana, the sphere of nothingness. And one would have to find very strong argument to argue against this in order to come to the conclusion that it means something else. So I think there's already these two very clear references. And then as concerning the passage I had quoted, Dhammapada verse, that by some is taken as proposing that the Brahmaviharas is a complete path to awakening itself. The situation, I think, is slightly different insofar as Brahmajala Sutta or also this Aryaparyesana Sutta, they fit within the general context. There's nothing explicitly confronting them and showing that this is otherwise. Whereas the idea that the Brahmaviharas are a complete path to awakening, is extracted from this one verse without considering all the other material in the Sutta Pitaka that clearly shows that insight, the cultivation of insight, is required for reaching full awakening. So I think here the situation is slightly different. We have two sutta passages, both of which are probably early, but one is interpreted on its own without considering the context. The other one, as far as I can see, fits very well with the context. Then he mentions a passage in the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha even refers to the four jhanas figuratively as a kind of nibbana. He calls them immediately visible nibbana, factorial nibbana, nibbana here and now. Yeah, this is definitely a difficult passage. And we have to see that just before this description also we get the description of an arahant, a so-called panya vimutto arahant, liberated by wisdom, which is exactly the same as an arahant liberated both ways, an ubhatubhaga vimutto. Even though everywhere else in the suttas and in later literature, in suttas of other traditions, they are clearly distinct types of arahants. And this whole part does not have any counterpart in the agamas. And so my understanding of this section of the Anguttara Nikaya that Justin has quoted is that this is a product of kind of error in oral transmission. There is these sections in the Samyutta and in the Anguttara Nikaya where we get the payalas. I wouldn't know how to translate payala. It's like you get a repetition series, but the same topic is treated from all kind of different perspectives. And so this goes, for example, everything is like the river Ganges, and then tsa-tsa-tsa-tsa-tsa, and then everything is like the river so-and-so. You get all these repetitive cycles, and one of the problems with Anguttara and Samyutta Nikaya is that it's very difficult to know how many suttas these collections actually have, because it really depends on how you count this repetition series. And this repetition series is also the case here for this passage from the Anguttara Nikaya. So I personally, my impression is that this description is in part due to this kind of repetition cycles. There's a question by Eric Van Horn. There's also evidence that states like the jhanas exist in other non-Indian mysticism, including Christianity. Exactly, yeah. The basic experience of deep concentration is not the sole domain of Buddhism. What is specific in Buddhism, I believe, to my knowledge, is the analytical approach. And this is what the suttas and also what later traditions always highlight. Thank you, Eric. Then a second question by Justin. The reference you gave for the Bodhisattva learning under other teachers, it seems none of them were in the Sutta Pitaka. So does this not seem strange that these are all absent in the early layer in the Sutta Pitaka? In principle, it is always a strong argument to say something is not found at all in the Sutta Pitaka. But in this case, we also have to take into account that there is no autobiography or biography of the Buddha at all in the Sutta Pitaka. And this is why I had posted this paper of mine on the Dhammacakka, where I discussed a little bit some of these arguments also made by other scholars who have seen discourses like Arya Pariyesana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 26, as if they were a complete autobiography. So I think we have to be very wary, and this is correct, of information that is not found in the Sutta Pitaka. And I have also, I believe when I mentioned this two lectures ago, I just said that other sources or traditions say that he did some learning under other teachers. This information is not certain, but the absence of that information is in itself also not strong evidence, because we in principle do not get a biography of the Buddha or in the suttas. The closest we get to any kind of, how shall we call this, histories would be the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, And this, I think, is generally held to be a text that originally developed in the Vinaya. And the way I understand it, said very simply, is you see in the Vinaya, the rules and regulations come with stories that explain how a particular rule was believed to have happened. We get the story that such and such a monk or such and such a nun did such and such a thing. The Buddha is told about it, and thereon he gives such and such a rule. These stories are not strictly speaking historical. As I've been able to show in another paper I published last year, the stories told there have a teaching purpose. Sometimes they are quite free because they want to pass on a message. But nevertheless, we have a kind of concern with history in quotation marks. And out of this concern naturally also comes a concern of providing some kind of history of Buddhism. It was not called Buddhism at that time, but of the Buddha, how he got awakened, how the first disciples. And this beginning of this kind of creating a history of Buddhism in quotation marks for later disciples, that I think would have led to the type of interest that we see in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. When the Mahaparinibbana Sutta itself is a mixture of early and late material. But we have a lot of early material in there too, but that is just the beginning. But even there, we do not give a full biography of the Buddha. The idea to provide a full biography of the Buddha's life and tell us what exactly happened comes historically simply later. And these are the texts that I quoted. The Jataka Atakata, the Nidanakata of the Jataka, Mahavastu, Lalita Vistara, etc. Yeah, that was... And I think I pretty much said in reply to Justin what I can offer on this topic of the immaterial spheres being part of early Buddhism or not. And I don't think I would continue further because at some point, I mean, you see, I can only say what I can see with the limits of my understanding and based on the study of the early discourses. But it's obviously everybody of you is free to disagree, and at some point also it then gets really into a kind of just arguing forth and back, and I'm not sure that is always helpful. So I am now with Michael Beisert. He is asking a question about this interim between death and rebirth. So I've cut off the first part of what he said, and then there is an interval between kayasabeda, so the destruction of the body, and parangmarana after death. And Nibbana is realized in that interval. Interestingly, this would tie up with the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which describes the luminous mind in the first stages of the process of dying. And then he continues, Bhikkhu Bodhi further explains that Theravada orthodoxy maintains that rebirth takes place immediately, with no intermediate stage between one life and the next. Based on the Sasankara Sutta and Anguttara Nikaya 755, Bhikkhu Bodhi argues that it is possible to assume that indeed there could be an intermediate state. He also mentioned that this was the position taken by the Sarvastivadins. So is it possible that Majjhima Agama 75 would be pointing in that direction? His question is in relation to the description in the Aniññasapaya Sutta, which uses the expression Sangvattanika Vijnana, the onward leading consciousness, which I mentioned last time has a parallel in the Tibetan, but is not explicitly mentioned in the Chinese. Now, first of all, about the intermediate state, and I thought that we had discussed it, but searching this morning when preparing for the lecture, I couldn't find the references, so I briefly go over this again. It is correct. In the early discourses, it seems that there is the idea of a period between death and being reborn. And this is particularly evident in the description of different types of non-returners, where we are told that a non-returner can reach full awakening either when passing away or on being reborn, or in between these two. This is the antara parinibbaya. So there, this very idea that a non-returner may make it to the final goal between death and being reborn clearly shows that in early Buddhist thought there was the idea that there is a period in between. And we also have a reference in the so-called Metta Sutta. This is Samyutta Nikaya 147, which uses the expression Bhutava Sambhavesiva. So those who have come to being and those who are in search or in quest of being. So this also gives us the impression that there is some idea here of a being that has already left one form of existence and is searching for another existence, has not yet really found that. And this, as Bhikkhu Bodhi pointed out, is also the position held in the traditional Savastivadin exegesis. But interestingly, the Theravadins do not hold this position, and they argue that there is the chuti, they call it chuti vijnana and patisandhi vijnana. There is the death consciousness, and the next moment is the relinking consciousness. You die, and tuck, you're reborn. Which is very interesting, I find, because it tells us again something about the reliability of the transmission, that even though the Theravadins very strongly argue that there is no in-between period, these passages in the Pali discourses that point to such a period have not been erased, have not been changed, or have been made to disappear. As far as the question whether Madhyama Agama discourse is pointing in that direction, I am not so sure. First of all, I am not sure if the Sangvattanika Vijnana, the expression in the Pali version, would be as strong evidence for the in-between period as the other examples I just mentioned. And I'm not quite sure what Michael intended with his question, but if he was asking whether there is a sectarian agenda behind this difference, then I do not think so, because the Tibetan version is from the Mula Savastivada tradition. So the Tibetan version of the Anindasapaya Sutta is from a school that is closely related to the Savastivada school, which transmitted the Madhyama Agama. And so if these two differ, it seems very improbable that the difference could be due to sectarian agendas. And then also one would expect the opposite. If the Sangvattanika Vijnana, the expression, gives us at least a pointer in the direction of an in-between period, it should be missing in the Pali and should be found in the Chinese, not the other way around. But maybe Michael was not asking about that, he was just asking in general about this type of in-between period. And he also wanted to know if such a person who attains full awakening in between would then be developing jhana in that in-between period. And that is a very interesting question for which I don't have any kind of answer. I mean, we only have these slight hints at this in-between period in the early suttas, but no elaborate explanations. Which I think in a way is interesting, because contrary to the emphasis we find in beautiful scriptures like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, where there is a very elaborate description of what happens after death, in the somewhat more pragmatic approach in early Buddhism, the concern is more with what one should cultivate before death. There's a lot of instructions on reflection on one's own mortality. There are discourses on hospice care, when you look after somebody else who is dying, how one should encourage that person to develop detachment. So it seems to me, in comparison to texts like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, in early Buddhism the emphasis is very much on what one does before death happens, so that one is really ready to meet that moment of death. There's a question by Samaneda Madina. Is the Theravada position related to the Theravada Abhidhamic development of momentariness, of consciousness? It's an interesting question. It certainly expresses itself in that framework with this idea of chutti vijnana and patisandhi vijnana. How far this directly influenced that position, I am not sure of, and because the development, the theory of momentariness is not specific to the Theravadins. The Sarvastivadins, I believe, also submit to that theory. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And the theory of momentariness would also be compatible with an idea of an in-between life. It would just be, say, there would be, to express it in Pali terminology, there would be the chutti vijnana, and then there would be a number of vijnanas or chittas, mind moments in the in-between period, and then the mind moment of being reborn. So, offhand, without really having studied this, I don't see a direct causal relation, but certainly you are right that they are expressing themselves within that language game framework of ideas. There's another topic that has been raised, excuse me, by Venerable Xin Qin Qi. According to Samyutta Nikaya 41.7 and Samyutta Agama 5.6.7, the measureless liberation of the mind, the liberation of mind by nothingness, the liberation of mind by emptiness, and the signless liberation of the mind can be different in meaning and different in phrasing. They can also be one in meaning and different only in phrasing. If the measureless liberation of the mind and the liberation of mind by nothingness can be one in meaning, does this mean that when the Brahma Viharas are cultivated with insight development, the formless attainment can be attained? Yeah, my understanding of the passage that Venerable Xin Qin Shi has quoted is that this is not necessarily about the issue of combining the Brahma Viharas with insight. My understanding is that there's a little bit of a playing with words. So there is this apamana citta vimutti, liberation of the mind, boundless liberation of the mind. So this is the traditional terminology used for the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, etc. And then there's akinchanya citta vimutti, the liberation of mind through nothingness, and this is of course the attainment of nothingness. And sunyata citta vimutti is then insight into the absence of a self, and animitta citta vimutti is the absence of any signs. But out of these four, only number three is specifically related to insight, the citta vimutti, that is sunyata, emptiness. But now there comes a wordplay in saying, how can all of these also have the same meaning? And they come to have the same meaning if we kind of reinterpret apamana, akinchanya, and animitta. And this is what the sutta in fact does. It continues as, look, but they mean the same when we look at them in terms of pamana. Pamana is a boundary, a measurement, something that limits, because actually the real pamana is lust, hatred, and delusion. So the discourse says lust, hatred, and delusion are pamana karana. They are makers of limitations, of measurement. And so because the arahant, he or she has left behind these makers of measurement, the arahant actually is the true apamana citta vimutti, the real liberation of mind through boundlessness. And then the same wordplay is made with the others. So lust, hatred, and delusion are a kinchana, a something. And when the arahant is left behind lust, hatred, and delusion, then this is really akinchana citta vimutti. And this would even apply to an arahant who has not attained the immaterial spheres. And then again, the lust, hatred, and delusion are what makes a nimitta, what makes a sign, what marks you. And so somebody who is free from lust, hatred, and delusion, this is the true animitta citta vimutti. So I think this is just a little bit a playful way of showing that, of pointing again to this recurrent theme in the discourse, that there are these liberations of the mind in the realm of samatha, but hey, in the final count, it's all about liberation. That's the thing that is important. This is the way I understand this discourse. And then there's a second question by Venerable Sien Chinchur. According to the Visuddhimagga, when one develops the first three Brahma Viharas, he/she can only attain three jhanas in the fourfold scheme and four jhanas in the fivefold scheme. But Madhyama Agama, Samyukta Agama 743 and Samyutta Nikaya 4654 show that compassion, karuna, has the base of infinity of space as its culmination, and altruistic joy as the base of the infinity of consciousness as its culmination. When the Brahma Viharas are cultivated without insight development, and all have living beings as their meditation objects, is it possible for one to attain the formless attainments? Yes, I replied to the first and then the second part. I first also give a comment by Linda, who has also been talking about the same thing. So the explanation in the Visuddhimagga, I think, is based on the idea that the first three Brahma Viharas, loving kindness or benevolence, metta, compassion, karuna, and mudita, sympathetic or empathetic joy, are joyful mental states. And so with these, it is possible to develop those absorptions that are related to joy or happiness, which is number 1, 2, and 3 in the sutta scheme. But equanimity, because it is not in itself joyful, will not be an appropriate object to cultivate the first, the second, and the third absorption. So the idea is that when one develops the Brahma Viharas, one would be first working with 1, 2, or 3, metta, karuna, mudita, and cultivate the first, second, and third absorption. And when one has reached that degree of mastery of the mind, that one is able to attain the third absorption, then one takes up the object of upekkha, of equanimity, and uses that to enter the fourth absorption. I am not aware of anything in the suttas that would directly contradict this, and to my knowledge, this is also the position taken by meditation teachers with whom I discussed this. Now, the second part of Venerable Sien Chinchur's question, and also Linda Grace commented on this, excuse me, I know that cultivation of metta can result in liberation of the mind, having the beautiful as its culmination. The sutta then goes on to explain how the liberation of the mind by equanimity could have the base of nothingness as its culmination, for a wise bhikkhu has not penetrated to a superior liberation, which makes sense. However, I am curious why the liberation of mind by compassion has the base of infinity of space as its culmination, and the liberation of mind by altruistic joy has the base of the infinity of consciousness as its culmination, or liberation. In other words, what is the reason for specifically correlating compassion with infinite space and sympathetic joy with infinite consciousness? Is it simply the order and the progressive nature of both series? That is to say, the increasingly subtle perceptions resulting in ever more refined states of consciousness. Hasn't taken in the last part of my quote, I put it again. In either case, the objects developed to this extent are boundless and formless. Yeah, the precise correlation is not immediately self-evident. What is, I think, clear is that there's a close relationship between the Brahma Viharas and the immaterial spheres, again, points to the type of meditation practice that the Brahma Viharas were in early Buddhism, where they were not concerned about what is the usual mode nowadays, one particular person as a friend and another particular person as a neutral person and a third particular person as an enemy, and then one cultivates these states towards these different beings in turn and also towards oneself, but much rather, as the name Appamana says, a boundless radiation, a very spacious type of mind, and so something that very easily is has a taste that is very similar to the immaterial attainments. And the way the correlation is usually explained is that with compassion, one becomes really aware of the dukkha, of the pain and difficulties and suffering of other beings. And much of the kind of suffering and problems that we as human beings are able to witness with other beings has really to do with having a body. Hunger, thirst, abuse, war, rape, you call it. If we would just be spacious beings, spacing out, much of these problems would not really arise. This does not mean that becoming a space being is the solution, but it just this is the way how there can be some kind of a connection between the idea of cultivating compassion and boundless space. And with sympathetic joy or empathetic joy, mudita, the mudita anumodana, rejoicing the good in others. The good others do has a lot to do with the mind, with their intentions, with where they come from. It's slightly more refined, and it does then have some relation to consciousness. And the connection between equanimity and nothingness, as Liz and Linda said, is quite obvious. But as Linda said, it is simply possible that this is a parallelism between progressive refinement in mental cultivation between the Brahmaviharas and the immaterial spheres. So this is the best explanation that I can come up with, but if you find this forced, then I have to accept that, because it's not immediately self-evident, the one-to-one correlation. I agree on that. And to me, the strong statement of this passage is more the general relationship between the Brahmaviharas and the immaterial spheres. But to come back to what Venerable Sienchen has said, I do not see a necessary relationship to the cultivation of insight. It is mentioned in the Pali version of this discourse that the Brahmaviharas are practiced in relation to the awakening factors, and this is a very important part that shows how the Brahmaviharas can be harnessed to the cultivation of insight. But I think if we look at it from a plain perspective of meditative cultivation, even someone who has not developed any insight in the Buddhist sense, he or she would certainly be able to develop the Brahmaviharas, and let us suppose he or she does it according to this prescription from the Visuddhimagga, doing the first three jhanas with metta, karuna, mudita, then the fourth absorption with upekkha, with equanimity, and after that, because of that, having already that experience of developing a boundless mind and being established in the meditative, concentrative strength of the fourth absorption, it should be very easy to develop the immaterial spheres. And this kind of development would not require any deeper insight in the Buddhist sense, above and the basic understanding of how the mind works and how I'm able to get concentrated. Now we come to the Anindya Sapaya Sutta. Excuse me. Oh, today I got it. This is Atma Domayankom. He's asking about the three approaches to imperturbability, which we have here on the board. And Venerable Sienchen had also asked the same question about the three approaches to nothingness. So he says, excuse me, a certain point is not completely clear for me. Do these three contemplations the same, or have they only the same effect, respectively? Are these three contemplations only different aspects of one contemplation, or are they really different contemplation? Yeah, so I have here tried to summarize the main points of the Anindasapaya Sutta and its paths in the way I understand them. So it seems to me that this is kind of working through. There's a fifth one which doesn't stay on there. No. Anyway. There's like five graded points the discourse makes. And path to imperturbability, which is a term regularly associated with the fourth absorption and with the immaterial spheres, but at few occasions it also used to describe the Arahant, who is simply imperturbable by his or her freedom of the mind. These three paths to imperturbability, I understand them as alternative options. And my understanding would be that these describe insights that help one to progress towards deeper concentration. So, when somebody sits down to, let's just be very simple and basic. When somebody sits down to meditate, then the problem is, of course, that the mind does not do what one wants to do. It does not just simply stay there, get concentrated, calm, peaceful, and blissful, but starts running here and there. And these distractions that come up are a very clear reflection of the nature of one's own mind. And here there are several ways of dealing with that. And so for someone for whom sensual pleasures are attractive, that could be full out sexual fantasies, but could also be being on a retreat and thinking of some nice chocolate or whatever, the clear understanding that sensual pleasures are what is defiling for me. It's something that brings me down, and it's an obstruction to what I'm trying to do here. And this insight, the stronger this insight is developed, the more the ground, the nourishment on which these distractions flourish becomes eroded, becomes less. Someone else might be less concerned with sensual pleasures in general, but more with visions. This could be visions of beautiful members of the other sex, but it could also be beautiful other things that one wants to see. And again, this kind of deconstructing that fascination with visual things by making, look, it's all just four elements. It's another mode of insight. I recently had that opportunity. I was in a place where it was something really very beautiful and people taking pictures, and I saw these same things, and I just had this reflection, look, it's just four elements. And this whole fascination with it just completely collapsed. And a third approach is then to see that, look, it's all changing. Whatever piece of chocolate I get, whatever beautiful landscape I see, any perception I have is something that changes. So I see these as three different approaches that can help to approach that degree of mental imperturbability, of deep concentration. And of course, it doesn't mean that one should only take one and never take the others. It really depends on the situation and on one's personal inclinations. But one can use all three, alternate, or one can find one as a particular propensity towards this type of distraction and then work with the corresponding type of insight. Cultivate that insight in order to help the mind to go deeper in concentration. And this is the fascinating thing about it. You see let me not say this too strongly, but what we do not so often get in modern day meditation instructions is this type of insight. At least, I mean, some of the teachers that I trained with, it's basically just go back, concentrate. There's no, it's just as if on this kind of skill, this refined skill that we find here in this instruction, like you see what is the things that distract you and then use insight to counter that, is not the potential of such type of an approach is not made use of as much as it could, let me put it like this. And this is what is so powerful when one turns to these discourses, as one sees different doors open that can be helpful for the practice. And then the same is then for the path to nothingness. So one wants to go further and deeper in concentration, and there are these insight approaches, looking at the cessation of perceptions. All perceptions cease anyway, so why not let them cease now? Or the empty of self, this whole thing of the problem of latching on to experiences in deep concentrations as something that, I got it. Oh, wonderful. Mine. This I am. This whole theme comes in there, and while it is a central aspect of Buddhist insight, obviously, and the point is to lead to nirvana, it also helps to deepen concentration. When one lets go of that sense of self. And then the path to neither perception nor non-perception, it's really about cessation of all perceptions. It's not itself the total cessation, but it is points in that direction. And then this pointing out that the difference between the same type of practice, whether it leads towards nirvana, whether it doesn't lead towards nirvana, is the question whether one clings to the experience. Whether the experience is seen as a pointer to something else, or whether the experience is seen as something in itself that has a value, that I got it now. It's a very, very subtle point. And then the whole presentation gets rounded off by this pointing out what is noble liberation, what is the liberation that really ennobles one. Nothingness, neither perception, non-perception, these are also liberations, but they are temporary liberations. And the ennobling liberation, the noble liberation, is when one realizes that all is just sakkāya, this kind of identity, the sense of identity. One's own body, literally. This is the way how I understand this progression. But there are also some contributions by others, which I would like to share with you on the meaning of this discourse. This is still Otmar Domeinko. This short summary, he's talking about the discourse, is made to show in brief how tranquility and insight increases step by step. In each single step, it is tranquility which guides to deeper insight, and deeper insight guides to deeper tranquility, until the next step is reached, and so on. This sutta looks like a bhikkhu on a swing. If he wants to reach a higher level of insight in front of him, he needs to swing back to higher of tranquility. And if he wants to reach a higher level of tranquility behind him, he needs to swing forward to a higher level of insight. I thought that was very beautiful. Linda Grace has something similar. To me, the key theme of the third sutta is to illustrate how Nibbana can be realized dependent on various provisional bases. Yet each base is only to be used as a temporary support that itself must then be abandoned. However, one does not need to attain all the various levels of samadhi in order to reach the final goal. At any point, if wisdom is strong enough, it can break through to the realization of Nibbana. If not, one can use insight all the way from contemplating the dangers of sensual desire to the perception of emptiness to deepen samadhi, such that finer and finer levels of perception and experience can then be investigated and seen through, ultimately to the liberation of the mind through non-clinging. To me, this also speaks to both the progressive and immediate nature of realization. Or perhaps an imagery could be that sometimes one door may open to the deathless, sometimes one door after another may need to be opened. One can use insight to do so, and then each increasing subtle space. something missing. Realm entered can be used as a way to open the next door, enter the next realm, so to speak. But ultimately, wherever consciousness has landed, no matter how helpful, how peaceful, that support must be relinquished and abandoned. Yeah. And Linda also points out that there is a difference that in the Pali version, this is made more explicit, where it says, the Buddha says that he has taught the crossing of the flood in dependence on one support or another. Nisaya, Nisaya, Yoga, Satarang. That one sentence is not found in the Chinese. And as she rightly points out, it actually really sums up an important part of the discourse, this step-by-step approach in reliance on one support of honor or another, which one has to let go of all of them. And she asks about what is noble liberation. Yeah. And then she mentions that, I just put this from her comment. She asks about the last part about noble liberation. Whoops. Yeah. And she says, I just read Bhikkhu Bodhi's footnote 101 explaining the commentary view about this question. I don't find this view convincing, especially given the subject matter of the sutta. And so here is Bhikkhu Bodhi's note, where this is not his opinion, he's just giving the explanation provided in the commentary. Ananda's question, this is the question that leads up to point number 5 in the handout. Ananda's question is intended to elicit from the Buddha an account of the practice of the dry insight meditator, Sukha Vipassaka, who attains arahantship without depending on a jhanic attainment. Yeah, and I fully agree with Linda. It seems that this comment does not reflect a very profound understanding of the discourse, what the Pali commentary tradition here has to offer. I fail to see how this could be about dry insight. It really seems to me, just to round off this whole presentation, is this showing insight leading to imperturbability, insight leading to nothingness, insight leading to neither perception nor non-perception, then thematizing what is the path to nirvana when one does not cling, and then show that whatever it is, the noble type of liberation is when one lets go of this sense of identity. I also don't see a relationship here to dry insight. And the final contribution by Kim Allen. A key point in the development process of consciousness is to reach the fourth jhana characterized by imperturbability, that is, perfect equanimity. Such a mind does not react or cling to any object and is thus able to observe the flow of experience perfectly. This makes the state ideal for gaining insight. But in the process of reaching this secluded state, the mind naturally notices that the cessation of perception is peaceful, which is one of the reflections offered in Majjhima Nikaya 106 also. It has let go of vitakka, vichara, piti, etc. These are the jhana factors. In the process of getting there. So it is natural that the mind can continue to drop perceptions and experience the resulting peace, which is the process of entering the successive formless jhanas. Although formless jhana is not in itself a path to nirvana, through mastering these states, the mind is deepening its understanding and conviction that indeed the cessation of any perception is more peaceful than even the most peaceful perception, tranquility and insight together. Some minds will refine all the way to the experience of neither perception nor non-perception. All of this is practice for the mind to be willing to allow all experience to cease. Beautiful. Very nice. So this is on the Anindya Sapaya Sutta again, Thanks to all of you. There's a question by Samaniri Damadina. Linda, simile of the doors reminds me of the simile of the bundle of reeds. If one were to pull away one of them, the other would fall and vice versa. Nama, rupa and consciousness. Yeah. All doors opened. Yeah. It's interesting that the bundle of reeds simile in the Samyukta Agama, there are three bundles of reeds. One for nama, one for rupa and one for consciousness, which I don't think works so well. Because if one pulls out the rupa reed bundle, the others still stand. Anyway, this is not really relevant. But yeah, this is very similar. So this is, I think, on the Anindya Sapaya Sutta. And now we get into our next discourse. The discourse at Upankachila. And what I wanted to say before I start reading the discourse is that it is only in the course of preparing the series of lectures for this semester that I found that this discourse has two parallels. Yeah, so I just wanted to introduce you to this whole issue of parallels. This book here by Chitsun Akanuma is like the standard work for identifying parallels. And this is an incredibly useful work done by the Chinese scholar many, many years ago. And he basically, the thing is, you see, the Pali discourses are in one order and the Chinese are in another order. And in order to actually know who is a parallel to whom, one has to identify them individually. And this is, Akanuma has done a wonderful work for us here, because he simply, you see, he read it all, and then, oh wait, this one has a parallel here. Oh, this one has a parallel there. So he constructed this whole catalog where which Chinese Agama discourse has a Pali parallel, which Pali parallel has a Chinese Agama discourse parallel. And this is something that still goes on. We have a website for that, Sutta Central, where myself and other scholars interested in this type of issue are contributing whenever we identify new parallels. So thanks to you in this course now, we have identified that Madhyama Agama 76 has a parallel also in the Anguttara Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya 863. This parallel, to my knowledge, has not been discovered earlier. And the whole situation of this discourse is very interesting for those of us who are thinking also about this whole issue of transmission of text, because basically Madhyama Agama 76, the first part is more similar to the Samyutta Nikaya parallel, and the second part is more similar to the Anguttara Nikaya parallel. And it seems difficult to explain the situation. The most probable possibility is perhaps that there was Madhyama Agama is a coming together of two originally different discourses, or the two Pali version are a separation of one discourse. It's a little difficult to see, but these kind of differences are very interesting and show how the texts were moving around and changing during this whole flow of oral transmission. So I begin with the discourse. At that time in the afternoon, a certain monk rose from sitting in meditation, approached the Buddha, paid homage at the Buddha's feet, and sitting to one side, said, "May the Blessed One teach me the Dharma well and in brief. Having heard the Dharma from the Blessed One, I will stay in a remote and solitary place and practice diligently with the mind free of ignorance." Through staying in a remote and solitary place and practicing diligently with a mind free of indolence, may I accomplish the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen shave off hair and beard, don the yellow robe, leave home out of faith, and go forth to practice in the path. May I, in this very life, personally attain understanding and awakening, and dwell having personally realized it. May I know as it really is, birth is ended, the holy life has been established. What was to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. So basically he is saying to the Buddha that he wants to now go and practice on his own to reach awakening, and he wants an instruction. This is a very regular occurrence in the discourses. What is interesting is that in the parallel, in the Chinese version, we will say the Buddha just gives him an instruction. But in the Pali parallel, in both of the parallels that we have been identifying, the Buddha actually upbraids him. I read for you Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. It is in just such a way that some foolish persons here make requests of me, but when the Dhamma has been spoken to them, they think only of following me around. So in both Pali versions, the Buddha actually upbraids the monk, and then the monk asks again, and only then the Buddha gives him an instruction. And this whole episode is not found in the Madhyama Agama. And I have several times found that when the Buddha seems particularly harsh in Pali discourses, that this is not found in the Chinese. And at least in one case, this is the discourse to Satchaka, it seems clear that I have argued that the Chinese parallel is probably the more original version. In the present case, I simply do not know whether we should consider the Chinese or the Pali as the earlier version, but I just like to notice this tendency somewhat in the Pali discourses to show the Buddha as a rather stern teacher. There's a question by Martin Seidensticker. Yeah, suttacenter.net is the website where you can find the almost latest information on parallels to Pali and Chinese Agama discourses. So in the Chinese, the Buddha immediately gives him instruction. There's no insinuation that the monk may have been lazy or not practicing properly or anything. The Blessed One said, monk, you should train in such a way that the mind becomes settled, staying imperturbable within, developing immeasurable wholesome factors. Again, contemplate the internal body as body, dwelling with utmost diligence, with right mindfulness and right attentiveness established. Taming your own mind well, so that covetousness is left behind and the mind is without dejection. Again, contemplate the external body, the internal and the external body. Monk, having thus established concentration, you should develop it well when going and when coming, when standing, when sitting, when lying down, when going to sleep, when waking up, when sleeping and waking, you should develop it well. Again, you should develop well concentration with directed awareness and sustained contemplation. These are the Chinese counterparts to vitaka and vichara, the factors of the first jhana. Without directed awareness but with only sustained contemplation, without directed awareness and without sustained conjoint with rapture, conjoined with happiness, conjoined with totally stable concentration, conjoined with equanimity. And then the discourse continues by moving through the same pattern for feelings, mental states and dharmas. There are several things I would like to comment on. One is there's a difference in sequence, in that in the Pali version you will all get all four satipatthanas together before moving on to the next topic. Let me just see here. Yeah, so the Pali version starts with virtue and right view, and then it gives all the four satipatthanas, and that is where the Samyutta Nikaya version stops. And the, let me just check. Yeah, I'm sorry, I got the wrong page. Give me a second. Yeah. Yeah, so in the Pali version we also get something about developing concentration first of all, which we also have here, about imperturbability, staying imperturbable within. So there's clearly, the mind becomes settled, staying imperturbable within. There's clearly an allusion to a development of concentration. And based on that concentration, now here he first does the loving kindness and the Brahma Vihas, which then come later. And only afterwards he goes for the Satipatthana. So there's the sequence of these different elements is different in the parallel versions. But what we get very clearly is that there is a first hint at developing some degree of concentration, and then we get the Satipatthanas, and the Pali version, they come together. And then we get this same practice as being applied in everyday situations, standing, sitting, lying down. And then it moves on to concentration with directed awareness and sustained contemplation, which points to jhana attainment. And we will see later on that it also moves here into the Brahma Viharas. So this whole discourse is, as far as I can see, about the interrelationship between concentration and Satipatthana. It's a very interesting topic. But first, before I come to that, I wanted to briefly comment on this idea of internal and external Satipatthana meditation. Later tradition and modern meditation teachers have a number of explanations on this, but my impression is that as far as the early discourses are concerned, the idea of external Satipatthana refers to being mindful of others. Something that in this situation here with the e-learning, I can't do very well because I don't see you, I don't hear you. Sometimes I get somebody who switches on this clapping sign or the smiley, but this is about all I get. But in a normal situation, it is possible to be mindful of what others do, where they come from, how what I'm doing affects them. And so, first of all, here's a little bit of evidence to support this. This is the Jhanavasava Sutta, and this very explicitly uses the Bahidha Parakaya, it says, externally the body of others. This is very clear that here externally means others, the body, feeling, minds, etc. of others. And this is also the case for a Chinese parallel in the Dirga Agama. Then we have the Salayatana Vibhanga Sutta. This is a discourse we also have the similar exposition in Chinese, in the Madhyama Agama, I believe, and a Tibetan version. This describes the Buddha's practice of three Satipatthanas. And these three Satipatthanas, this is something specific quality of the Buddha, are about the way they are about the way he's aware of whether his disciples listen or don't listen. So there are three, because there are three possible situations. One is that nobody is really paying attention. One is that some are paying attention, some are not paying attention. And the third is everybody is listening to what he says. And so his ability to know the reaction of his listeners is referred to with the term Satipatthana, which is the same term usually used for the four Satipatthanas that we are all so familiar with. And while this is in the discourses, this is specifically associated with the Buddha, I think for all of us who have already given a talk in public, or even when we talk in front of a little group of friends, this is something that is possible and that we can see. We feel that when we are talking and suddenly everybody goes like looking down or looking away, going like this, I mean, it's quite obvious that we are not really catching their attention. And if everybody's like listening and big eyes and taking really in what we said, then we can understand, oh, what I'm saying is really interesting for them and is really relevant for them. And a third reference, this is the excuse me, the Sampasada Niya Sutta. Again, we have the same also in the Chinese parallel, and they describe different ways of knowing the mind of someone else. And one way is by reflecting on what one hears or what one sees. So it seems to me that the idea of external satipatthana is really about understanding what's happening with others. And this points very strongly to the continuity of satipatthana meditation outside of formal sitting. And it also supports a reconstruction of the Satipatthana Sutta based on those elements that are found in old versions, which in the case of body contemplation is the contemplation of the body as being made of different anatomical parts consisting of physical elements and the corpse contemplation, because these are all things that I can also easily contemplate in others. And feelings, we can know. We say something to somebody and, oh, they look like this. We understand, oh, this has been depressing for them. Or and somebody is suddenly smiling when we say something. You know, what I've just been saying is giving him a pleasant feeling. And we can also recognize the state of mind of someone else. And the original version of the fourth Satipatthana, contemplation of dharmas, appears to have been basically just the removal of the hindrances and the cultivation of the awakening factors. I am discussing this in more detail in a forthcoming book on Satipatthana that will be out by the end of the year. And these are also qualities that to some extent we can see in others. We can see when somebody is under the influence of a hindrance, or if somebody is cultivating these qualities that are singled out as awakening factors. That was about external satipatthana. So we see here a basis of concentration. I think I stick with the Madhyama Agama version, because as you saw right now, trying to figure out with the two different parallels, it becomes a little bit complicated. There's a basis of strong concentration already developed, and then this is used to contemplate the body, feeling, mental states and dharmas, internally, externally and both. Then this is used during everyday activities, and then this is used as a basis for developing concentration for going into jhana. And this is an important point, not always recognized in modern days, that the cultivation of satipatthana makes an immense contribution to samatha. Its main purpose is, of course, liberation leading to nirvana. This is what the Satipatthana Sutta explicitly says. But the cultivation of satipatthana, the establishing of mindfulness, can go a long way in giving a basis for the development of deep concentration going into jhana. However, this does not mean that satipatthana and jhana are the same. I think we need to be careful. Obviously, this kind of very strict or sharp division that tradition sometimes has made between tranquility and insight is problematic, and I think you probably agree with me that as we are reading the discourses, we become more and more aware of the fact how tranquility and insight are really interrelated qualities. The last discourse, the Anandasapaya, was very strong on that. Interrelated in a way that many of us, at least myself, before understanding this discourse, wouldn't even have thought of. Insight can make a contribution to tranquility in this way. Wow. But at the same time, now moving out of this black and white kind of division, these two separate boxes almost, we should also be careful not to throw it all together into one thing. As far as I can understand, satipatthana meditation and being in an absorption are different. Satipatthana meditation is about seeing change. and seeing conditionality. And absorption, the way I can understand it based on the early discourse, is about mental unification, about an unmoving, stable condition of the mind where there is precisely no change and where it's therefore not really possible to see conditionality. And to my knowledge also, there is no... The early discourses do not really explicitly support the idea that jhana and satipatthana are the same, with one exception, and this is the Dantabhumi Sutta. I'm just giving you the reference here. In the Dantabhumi Sutta, we get a description of satipatthana, then satipatthana practiced without thinking thoughts, and then this leads directly to the second absorption. So if we take this discourse as it has come down to us in the Pali version of the Theravada tradition, it gives the impression that just not thinking while doing satipatthana is the same as attaining the first absorption. And I am personally interested because this Dantabhumi Sutta has really struck me a long time ago, and it's the discourse that got me into Chinese. Yeah, I really wanted to know what's happening in the Chinese, and when I didn't know any Chinese, I wrote to somebody in Hong Kong. I think I got their address through a Singhalese friend of mine, and just asked them to look it up for me. And the Dantabhumi Sutta is also the first discourse where I published an English translation of the Chinese parallel and a detailed study. By now I have done so many of these, but at that time I was like, wow, something very special for me. Anyhow, in this comparative study, I found, first of all, the Chinese version does mention the first jhana. It has the four jhanas in abbreviated version, but it's very clearly the first jhana is there. And also overall, we can see that the Dantabhumi Sutta, in the Pali version, there are several problems in transmission, where the Pali discourse has clearly lost some text or misplaced it. There are internal incoherences in the sense that we get the removal of the five hindrances, and after that we get the satipatthana, which is then done to remove memories and intentions related to the household life. Once the five hindrances have been removed, that would no longer be necessary. And the Dantabhumi Sutta, the stages of taming, it describes the progress in meditation with a very beautiful simile of taming a forest elephant. But in the Pali version, several stages of this taming are lost. And all of these can be reconstructed with the Madhyama Agama version. So this is a very clearly, I think, a case of a discourse that has suffer during transmission, and the absence of the first absorption can very easily be explained through an error in memorization, because the passage on satipatthana without thought, excuse me, says ma vitakkan vitakkesi, don't think a thought. Now when you hear the word vitakka and you understand, don't think a thought, it is very natural for the reciter to continue after ma vitakkan vitakkesi, vitakka vichara nan vupassama, the appeasement of thought and vichara. It's actually much more natural, if you do recitation of Pali text, it's much more natural to continue with vitakka vichara nan vupassama instead of going for viviceva kamehi. But viviceva kamehi is the beginning of the first jhana, and this should be coming there now. And not vitakka vicharanam vupassama, which is the introductory phrase for getting into the second absorption. So a very typical error during oral transmission would easily explain why the first absorption is not mentioned in the Dantabhumi Sutta. And this must have happened, the loss must have happened at some point in time after it's separated from its Chinese parallel. Yeah, that was basically... Yeah, I just want to read the continuity of the discourse. you should dwell pervading one direction with the mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, the third, and the fourth direction, and also the four intermediate directions, above and below, all around, everywhere. With the mind imbued with loving kindness, free from fetters or resentment, without ill will or contention, you should dwell pervading the entire world with a mind that is boundless, exalted, immeasurable, and well cultivated. Similarly, you should imbue your mind with compassion, with empathetic joy, and with equanimity. I'm not going to read this, you know it. Monk, when you have developed this concentration, when you have developed it extremely well, if you wander in the eastern direction, you will certainly be at ease, free from the numerous dukkhas and afflictions. If you wander in the southern direction, the western direction, the northern direction, you will certainly be at ease, free from the numerous dukkhas and afflictions. Monk, when you develop this concentration, when you have developed it extremely well, then I do not say that you will merely maintain wholesome stage, much less that you will regress. Rather, I say you will by day and by night increase in those wholesome states without regression. When you have developed this concentration, when you have developed it extremely well, then you will certainly attain one of two fruits. Either you will attain final knowledge in this life, or else, if there is a remainder of clinging, you will attain non-return. Thereupon that monk, having heard what the Buddha said, having received it well and retained it well, rose from his seat, paid homage at the Buddha's feet, circumambulated him three times and left. Bearing in mind the instructions from the Buddha, he stayed in a remote and solitary place and practiced diligently with the mind free of indolence. Through staying in a remote and solitary place, practicing diligently with the mind free of indolence, he accomplished the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen shave off hair and beard, don the yellow robes, leave home out of faith, and go forth to practice the path. In this very life, he personally attained understanding and awakening, and dwelt having personally realized it. He knew as it really is, birth is ended, the holy life has been established. What has to be done has been done. There will not be another existence. Then Venerable One, having understood the Dharma, became an Arahant. Yeah, so the main point that I see in this discourse is the potential of Satipatthana to lead to the development of deep concentration. We still have a little time, and I think I would like to continue to the next one. I hope that is not going to be too much here, but it's good if we move on a little bit. Because this topic of Satipatthana and concentration, we will get a more detailed look at it in the parallel to the Kayagata Sati Sutta. But now there are a few other discourses in between that I would like to move through so that we get enough time to really look at the discourse on mindfulness of the body, which I think is very important for meditation purposes and for our overall theme of insight and tranquility. So I continue with Madhyama Agama 77, which is the parallel to the Nalakapana Sutta. At that time in Saketa, there were three clansmen, the Venerable Anuruddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbila, who had just gone forth together at a young age to train, having recently come to enter this true Dharma together. You might remember them. These are the three that we met already in Upakilesa Sutta a few weeks ago. At that time, the Blessed One asked the monks, "These three clansmen who have just gone forth together at a young age to train, having recently come to enter this true Dharma together, do these three clansmen delight in practicing the holy life in this true Dharma and discipline?" Then all of the monks kept silent and did not reply. And that happens the second and the third time. And I just wanted to comment that for somebody who comes from Asia, who has lived in Asia, this is perfectly natural. But from a Western perspective, this is a little puzzling, and one wonders what's happening there. In Asia, it is very normal that one, like say you are in front of me and there's a third person, I want to know how you are doing, I will ask the other person. It's a kind of a form of politeness. You are there, you're here at all, but you're not being directly asked, because that could be embarrassing. And the other thing, what we usually do is, one thing I learned in Sri Lanka, which is very nice, when you see somebody after a long time, then you ask them, the first thing is you ask them a question that is totally unproblematic and that they can easily agree to. So what I will say is like, Avada, did you come? And the other one say, hey, Hamdru, Ava, yes, I came. Which from a Western perspective is totally silly because, I mean, obviously I see that he has come. What are you asking? But that is not at all the point. The point is by doing this kind of exchange, oh, did you come? And yes, I came. It covers another perspective of communication that in the West we often overlook, the creation of a good feeling and an energetic connection. It's not just about exchange of information. And so I understand. I just want to give this little background for this. It's simply for the Buddha. He first asked the other monks, and then when they don't say anything, then he asks Anuruddha and the others themselves. Then the Blessed One himself asked the three clansmen, saying to the Venerable Anuruddha, excuse me. You three clansmen have just gone forth together at a young age to train, having recently come to enter this true Dharma together. Anuruddha, do you all delight in practicing the holy life in this true Dharma and discipline? The Venerable Anuruddha replied, that is so, Blessed One. We do delight in practicing the holy life in this true Dharma and discipline. The Blessed One said, Anuruddha, you were in your youth, young lads with completely black hair and healthy bodies. You could have delighted in recreation, delighted in bathing frequently, adorning the body, being surrounded by relatives and parents who cherish you, who with weeping and tears did not wish you to go forth to train in the path. And yet, you were able to shave off hair and beard, don the yellow robe, leave home out of faith and go forth to practice the path. Anuruddha, you are not training in the path out of fear of kings, or fear of robbers, or fear of debts, or other fears, nor are you training in the path because you fear poverty and inability to gain a living. Is it not rather because you are weary of birth, old age, disease, death, sorrow and distress, and wish to transcend this great mass of dukkha? Anuruddha, is it not out of such a state of mind that you have gone forth to train in the path? He answered, that is so. Anuruddha, if a clansman goes forth to train in the path because of such a state of mind, does he know the way to attain countless wholesome states? The Venerable Anuruddha said to the Blessed One, the Blessed One is the source of the Dharma, the Blessed One is the master of the Dharma, the Dharma is there because of the Blessed One. May he explain this. Having heard it, we will come to know the meaning fully. So basically, the Buddha is recalling, clarifying the intention to these young monks. Why did you actually go forth? And then, do you know how you should practice, how you should progress in your practice? And he's going to explain that now. The Blessed One said, Anuruddha, if one is overwhelmed by desires, is in the grip of evil states, then one does not attain the happiness of renunciation, the supreme peace of tranquility. One's mind may give rise to covetousness, ill will, and sloth and torpor. The mind may give rise to discontent. The body may become lethargic, and one may overeat and become depressed. Yeah, here we have a difference in the Pali version. The listing is of the five hindrances, which it seems to me fits the context better. I continue reading. Such a monk is unable to bear hunger and thirst, cold and heat, mosquitoes, gadflies, flies and fleas, and irritation by the wind or the sun. He is also unable to bear evil speech or being beaten with sticks. Or when the body encounters all sorts of diseases, so painful that one wishes to end one's life, so whatever else is undesirable, all of that he is unable to endure. I think we are here getting a pointer to the benefit of tranquility for dealing with the vicissitudes of life. Why? I continue. Because he is overwhelmed by desires, is in the grip of evil states. He does not attain the happiness of renunciation, the supreme peace of tranquility. Happiness of renunciation refers to the happiness of deep concentration. If he is separated from desire and not in the grip of evil states, he will certainly attain the happiness of renunciation, the supreme peace of tranquility. Then the mind will not give rise to covetousness, ill will, and sloth and torpor. The mind will not give rise to discontent. The body will not become lethargic, and one will not overeat and become depressed. Such a monk is able to bear hunger and thirst, etc., because he is not overwhelmed by desires, not in the grip of evil states, and will attain the happiness of renunciation, the supreme peace of tranquility. The description of the various vicissitudes that one can bear with is only found in the Madhyama Agama version in this case. But the overall description so far points to the importance, particularly when one lives a life as a monastic, but also when one lives a life as a lay disciple and foregoes certain pleasures. The importance that this is counterbalanced by the cultivation of inner happiness, the inner happiness that comes from tranquility, from samatha, from developing concentration. After this topic, then the next topic is about the rationale behind a conduct of restraint. The Blessed One asked, Anuruddha, for what reason does the Tathagata get rid of some, make use of some, endure some, stop some, and reject some? And again we get now Anuruddha saying the Blessed One is the root of the Dharma, etc. And then the Buddha replies, Anuruddha, it is not because the Tathagata has not eradicated the influx and defilements that are the root of future becoming, that result in affliction and dukkha, that are the cause of birth, old age, disease and death. And it is not because he does not have knowledge of having attained liberation, that he gets rid of some, makes use of some, endures some, stops some, and rejects some. Anuruddha, it is just because of this body, the six sense spheres, and the life faculty, that the Tathagata gets rid of some, makes use of some, endures some, stops some, and rejects some. Anuruddha, this is the reason why the Tathagata gets rid of some, etc. The point is that the Tathagata or the Arahant no longer has to follow a conduct of restraint in the sense of needing to do that in order to overcome defilements, because that part of the job is basically being done. But the conduct still continues. The fully awakened one in early Buddhism is still observing the same conduct and moral behavior as someone who is on the path to full awakening. There's no, I think it's called crazy wisdom in early Buddhism. It's simply the appropriate way of living for a fully awakened one. And also we are told in other passages that it also has the purpose of providing an example for others. There's one problem in this passage, and that it is that it speaks of removing or rejecting some. This is Vinodana in Pali, and we have a parallel description of these different activities in the second discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sabhasava Sutta. And there this idea of Vinodana refers to removing unwholesome thoughts of sensual desire, ill will and cruelty. And we have this problem in this discourse here, the Madhyama Agama version, and in its parallel. So both basically agree to describe that the Tathagata is removing unwholesome thoughts, which per definition should not arise in the first place. And so this seems a very clear case of a translation error, where the term Vinodana, because it comes in the same group of terms in an earlier discourse, easily could become part of this discourse also, even though as far as the content is concerned, we can be fairly sure that this was not there in the first place, because the reciters would not want to portray the Buddha as still having unwholesome thoughts. Another difference between the two discourses, this was not a difference, this was a problem found in both versions. Another discourse is that in difference is that in the Pali version there is more of a question and answer, and Buddha asked Anuruddha if they think that he has not already eradicated his defilements, which is a little bit unexpected as a question, because the context doesn't give the impression that Anuruddha and his companions had any doubts about the Buddha's attainment. This is again a place similar to what we had in the other discourse before, where in the Pali version the Buddha seems to be a little bit more tough than the way he is portrayed in the Chinese version. I think if it's okay with you, I continue 5 minutes more and finish this discourse, and we recover the extra time with another discourse, another lecture mail we stopped earlier, because it would be nice to finish this discourse. Yeah, you can't really say yes or no, no. So I'll just go ahead and... That's the problem, I don't have these supernatural powers. Yeah, so the Blessed One asked Anuruddha, for what reasons does the Tathagata stay in quiet places, beneath trees, in mountain forests, dwelling on high crags and peaceful places without noise, faraway places free of evil, free of people, places conducive to meditation? It is not because the Tathagata wishes to attain what he has not yet attained, wishes to gain what he has not yet gained, wishes to realize what he has not yet realized, that he stays in quiet places, beneath trees, in mountain forests, delighting in dwelling on high crags, in peaceful places without noise, faraway places free of evil and free of people, places conducive to meditation. Anuruddha, for two reasons that the Tathagata stays in quiet places, beneath trees, etc. The first is for the sake of a happy abiding for himself here and now. The second is because he has compassion for later generations, thinking, perhaps later generations will follow the example of the Tathagata and stay in quiet places, beneath trees, etc. So these are the two reasons. One is that it is pleasurable for himself to live a secluded lifestyle. It is the appropriate expression of being awakened that one delights in silent and quiet places. And the second one is because one knows this has an impact on others. This can provide an example that will be emulated. Yeah, I'm not sure if I should do the rest. Let me see. No, I think I stop here. It's getting too much. It's not good to rush things also. So I think we stop here, and the next topic that the discourse gets into is about why the Buddha announces when disciples have reached a certain attainment, and I think we will leave that for the next time. Otherwise it gets too... I'm trying to squeeze too much into it. So basically, so far, the discourse has been shown as the powerful effect of inner happiness, of tranquility, to be able to handle the vicissitudes of life, and the fact that the practice of restraint and living in seclusion are something that the fully awakened one still continues. These are integral aspects of the conduct of a fully awakened one or a Buddha. So that's it for today, and I look forward to your questions and comments on the forum. This is always very nice for me to see when you put up things and questions there. And see you in 1 week time, and we continue with the rest of the discourse.